Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 80, titled, How Free Are We in Our Choices?
It is. You now know what it is.
So how much choice do we really have? How much of
About
our
what?
Life is predetermined? So, for example, I had a divorce, right?
Yes.
Was it meant to be? Did we both fail? I mean, I don't feel now that I failed. I'm much stronger now, but...
I see, you feel good riddance. Well, that's lucky. He's probably a mess.
I don't know.
You don't know? Well, there are studies, you know, that a woman who lives by herself, who's not depressed about it, whatever reason, is better off at the end of a long period of time. But a man is not, because a man gets more taken care of, you know. And the woman does more caretaking. So it's more tiresome for the woman. There are studies like that. So we husbands should really be grateful. And a few of us tend to be. And there really are studies like that. But anyway, what is it? No, meant to be is a bunch of baloney. Meant to be is, it's all meant to be. You know, like this comes from a leftover of theism. Sort of infantile idea that there's daddy is up there, like taking care of it all and controlling it all. There's some omnipotent thing behind it all, so meant to be type of thing. So some sort of, or let's put it this way, let's say ultimate meant to be is like ridiculous. But relative meant to be in the sense that the best way to take anything seen that possibly seen as a misfortune is to say, okay, I did something previously, anything one doesn't like about it. Say someone left you. That you didn't want them to. Then you say, well, I must have left them in a previous life. So now I'm glad I've had the experience of being abandoned. And now I'm going to use that to, in a positive way, because I'll take responsibility for it. I'm not going to sit around and say there's an ultimate thing, like who is how much to blame and who, like a court case. Except after, of course, I've divided the property we earned together. That should be done rationally. But even though somebody else had the paycheck, maybe they couldn't have had it without being taken care of. So there's I'm not talking about, you know, practical matters. But on a karmic level, one says, well, I'm going to use this myself to develop my own, to evolve in my own way and be stronger in another time. And when I remarry my ex and fall in love again with my ex in a future life, I'll handle it better anyway. I don't know about that moron. But I'll handle it better, and I'll be cool about it. Maybe I won't go all the way with them. I'll fall in love, but I will like be more cool about it, be more universal about it, and I'll see the consequences. I'll exercise my intuition about the weird habits that the person had, like on that first date that I pretended not to notice to myself, because I was projecting wishfully like this was such and such a person. And meanwhile, every third word, they went like this. Now, next time, I'll notice that, and so on. And so blaming yourself when you're the victim is a way of empowering yourself. This is a very interesting Buddhist psychological teaching. You don't blame another. Now, you could turn it around and people like poor Sharon Stone got in terrible trouble in some earthquake in the Tibetan-Chinese border saying, oh, they're so mean to the Tibetans, they had a bad earthquake and all those children were killed in the bad-built schools and so on, that only Ai Weiwei is brave enough to speak up about in China. And that's wrong. Bodhisattva never does that. But then if the roof falls on oneself, then one says, oh, I knocked the roof down on some people. Because if you're angry at the others, there's no doing anything about it. You know, being angry at God or being angry at something, or I'm going to fix the world. You know, no, you fix yourself. You use misfortune as a fortune. You say, oh, okay, what doesn't kill me makes me stronger, like Nietzsche said. You know, you use it in a positive way. Because of that hermeneutical thing I said, you know, hermeneutics means the theories of interpretation, that in Buddhist thought, which is that all descriptions of relative reality are relative. They have a certain, so you could say they're rationalization, but they're useful and unuseful ones. You know, there are those that are strengthening and that lead one toward reality, and those that are more not weakening and lead away from reality. And the basic idea is that you say you're new to Buddhism, but you now really know Buddhism better than a lot of people. When someone asks you, what is Buddhism in this country, they go, Buddhism. Even the French spell it B-O-U-D, Buddha, le Buddha. They go, c'est ridicule, really ridiculous. But anyway, Buddha. And it's a short U in the Sanskrit. There is a U sound in Sanskrit, but Buddha's Buddha, not Buddha. And you say Buddhism is realism. Is what it is. That's all it is. It's realism. It's based on Buddha's discovery and his assurance given to unenlightened, unrealistic beings that if they knew their own reality, they would be truly happy and free from suffering. Because reality, ultimately, is bliss. Ignorance is suffering. And it blocks you from realizing the bliss of reality. That's really what Buddhism is. And everything else about it, whatever religious aspect it might have, what scientific aspect it have, what ethical aspects it have, social, political, whatever, all of it, institutional, all of it is an education process to come closer and closer to what is real. That's really what it is. And in that sense, some people who can't really investigate that much because of whatever their education or their predilection, they can think of it as something they believe in, and to them it's a religion. And those who really use it, they become full-time, they become mendicants, if they're in a society where they'll be supported. Otherwise, they're practical laypersons who support themselves, but then try to put their highest priority in discovering reality. They are using it as an education, as an evolutionary education, realizing that this moment of human life that we have, which we earn through a long effort of developing from lesser forms of life, and we somewhat collapsed into maybe from more divine forms, but we were too lazy in those forms, so we came back to this middle form, the human form. And we realized that it's a very brief moment, actually. When you do die, and unfortunately everyone is going to, when we die, that thing flashing before your eyes, your life flashes before your eyes. But that's the truth of life. It's like a Augenblick, as the Germans say, a finger snap at the end of it. Seems like, oh, when is it? I'm waiting for whatever, Oh, when is it going to happen? But actually, it's just a moment in cosmic time, split second. And then that's not the end, and then it's on with stuff. So whatever we didn't learn. Then the issue about how conscious are we and how free are our choices. We're not much free at all when we're unconscious, mostly. And when we can't look at our own reality, we're scared. We think, oh, maybe I'm really like a weirdo. Maybe I'm like a evil. Maybe I'm bad. Maybe, we're told by a lot of different forces that want to exploit us, that we're no good, that we're this and we're that, We're told that in our culture. And so we have those inner fears, so we don't want to look at our reality. And we say, oh, Freud, oh, great, I have a big unconscious. And if it gets too bad, I'll just go see a shrink, and they'll, vent a little bit, They'll drain off a little excess paranoia energy. And we sort of live like that, and we think we can get away with that because basically life is an illusion and we're really nothing. That's what science tells us today, material science. That's what they tell you. They tell you you don't exist, really. You think you exist, but you really don't. It's your brain tricks you into thinking so, and your genes are working with the brain to make you run around and dump your genes someplace. Create another person with a problem. But when you realize that, then you really want to get the advantage of being a conscious human being, and you really want to find your reality. You begin to decide, that's what I'm going to be, a realistic person. I'm going to really live according to what is realistic and practical. And then you will really look into your mind. Then you can become very free of choice. You can begin to control, because you can control your impulses. You begin to see what they are, and you learn to make choices about, I mean, I have an impulse to do this or that, and you make a choice based on experience and whatever. So you can then, a Buddha is a being who is totally conscious in all their choices. They say that a Buddha doesn't have to inhale upon exhaling, unless it's helpful to keep that particular coarse body present in the experience of other beings. But there's no automatic autonomic thing where they're going to like choke a bunch of other people to get the air, you know, and this spasm of trying to get air at the end of, you know, because it's driven by an unconscious autonomic nervous system, you know, got to have an air, you know. So then in a case where, you know, I have a mad scientist thought experiment where a mad scientist locks you in an airless chamber or a chamber with only so much air and has a timer on it, and there's 20 people in there and there's enough air for 3 people to live until the timer goes off and it opens and air comes in. And 7 people, if 10 people are breathing, they'll all die. And then what happens? So what do the people do? Which one decides to like stop breathing, or could decide to stop breathing so that others could live? Only an enlightened being, they say. And that's a very powerful definition, meaning that it is possible to become conscious of every tiny cellular function in your system. And that's apparently that's how Buddhahood is defined. Now, it could be false, could be a mistake, you know, could be a false claim. I can't guarantee you because I'm not one. Yet. But I learned enough about it to think it's reasonable, and I intend to be. Sooner or later, maybe 1,000 lifetimes from now, I don't know. Menla, will it still exist? Will planet Earth exist? I don't know. Yes.
Just along those lines, when, you know, yeah, when a Buddha does, or someone attaining Buddhahood does get the ability to make choices, as you're describing, is it possible? I don't know what the answer is, but is it possible that even a Buddha could make mistakes, or even a Buddha? I mean, is
no Buddha does not make mistakes.
Does not make mistakes.
No, they are functionally omniscient, in the sense of, like a CAT scan, you know, you go in that machine and then it produces a 3-dimensional picture of all the structures in your system depending on what its settings are, right? So in a sense, it reflects the full structure of everything by merging with it. So it creates a field that merges with it. So a Buddha is defined as a being that merges with the field of all being, and therefore exactly knows by being, what the structures are. And the most not a materialistic, the CAT scan is a materialistic analogy, but also mental as well, you know, super subtle as well as coarse material, you know, super just mind patterns as well. You know? That's how it's defined. Which is another inconceivability, in a way, from a person who can only imagine things as connected to myself versus the other. How could you do that? How could you be such a cloud being, like a vast cloud, infinite cloud? How would that be possible? Okay, another question. Yes.
I'm asking about industrial death.
The what?
Industrial death.
Industrial death?
If you die in a hospital.
Oh, yeah.
And let's say that it does take about 4 days, or there's many religions that also think that the spirit or the soul or the field of energy leaves the body.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there was an experiment in the 1970s where the Russians took infrared film and did see in red a...
Oh, seeing beings leave, they do? They have the Russians...
An energy field leave
those
the
Ruskies
body.
Those are great.
Aren't they great?
Ochen harasho.
Now, in Buddhist tradition, after somebody dies...
Yes.
Is there a tradition to sit with the person for 4 days, or how is the body treated?
Oh yeah, there is definitely such a tradition. That is the quote unquote Book of the Dead tradition. It was developed in Tibet, and there's a very interesting sort of what Westerners consider a legend, but I consider a fact, which is that book was compiled by someone in the 8th century. From knowledge that already existed in India for for 1,000 years or more. Mm-hmm. And but he hid it in Tibet for 700 years, or 600 years. It was not discovered again. He wrote it and buried it somewhere. And then some incarnation of himself or one of his students found it 600 years later, and then it was published and used broadly in the country. And I puzzled with that, wrestled with that when I was commissioned to translate that book again, and I wonder, like, why was it not useful? And for example, why we never had one in our European culture particularly? Sort of a few mystics have helped out some people, but basically we don't have a systematic one. And we certainly don't have one in America where death is totally put out of reality, you know, like it doesn't exist.
Yes, it's almost like bad manners.
People are zipped up and disappeared. Yeah. What?
It's almost like bad manners.
Yes, that's right, yes. Exactly. So I was thinking about it, and then I realized, of course, it has to do with the slave society level. It's proportional to how much of a slave society it is. And the societies are more slave societies, the more militarized they are. So someone who is reminded from as part of their normal part of culture of death all the time, and that they're going to die, they might be reluctant to spend their life pulling a lever and making widgets in a factory all day long for somebody. They might be reluctant to go out and get shot up on a battlefield for somebody. Maybe they decide they want to really use their life to experience something or to find out something about what it is, who they are. In other words, you know those movies where the asteroid is about to hit Washington, D.C. or Virginia Beach? For some reason, they have a real fascination for smashing down Virginia Beach. But if Bruce Willis doesn't blow it up, you know, before it gets to the Earth, it's going to hit Virginia Beach, right? And then everybody will die along the freeway. And in those things, what do people do when they know they're dying? They don't want to go to the office. They're not going to make widgets. They're not going to, like, work. You know, they want to go find their first love or their third love, or, you know what, they want to, like, have a meaningful moment, right? So Tibet, when Buddhism first came there, was a militarized conquest empire, actually, like the U.S. or like Genghis Khan or like whatever. It was an empire. They conquered people and looted and pillaged all over the place. And so they wanted to keep their people under control. So to be thinking about your death is totally liberating. It makes you want to be alive. And use your moments of life to your, at least your advantage, if you love some people to their advantage. But you're not going to just follow orders so much. You're going to be more individualistic. And it took hundreds of years for the Tibetans to gradually demilitarize and develop an economy and a culture where people who wanted to spend their lives seeking the meaning of life were supported by the culture as an honor, because that's what human life is about. You know, the paradox of social individualism is an amazing thing. It means that, remember in Star Trek, the deep, profound Star Trek, I think it's Spock who's always saying that the one is there for the many, and then Kirk is always saying the many are there for the one, and they have like this thing going on about it. And in a way, one is there for the many, if it's not voluntary on the part of the one, is a slave society. Because who is the many? It's like the dictatorship of the proletariat. You know, those communist czars, the Dalai Lama told me, because he was invited to many Eastern European countries when they were liberated. And he said the guest houses that he would stay in, bathtubs are like swimming pools. The beds were like, at least you could have half the village in the bed. These guys had amazing self-indulgences level. More than most czars and kings, you know. So, you know, when it's the many are in charge of the one, then there is no one who's the many, and somebody usurps that power of the many, and then it enslaves everybody. And individualism means that the whole society is for the full flowering of each individual. That's what the society is about. And each flowering of the individual is them becoming enlightened, of course, developing their love, their insight, their wisdom, their realism, their blissfulness. And of course people say, oh, that's impossible. Then it would explode. You know, everybody would just want everybody's thing. Well, actually, luckily, when the individual is really very free, they become very loving of other individuals, and actually things work well that way. They find out that real joy comes from love, not just from grabbing and consuming, right? They discover that. So I forgot what was your question. Oh, so I'm sorry. So what was the main point of the question?
The main point is if you die in a hospital.
Oh, in hospital,
all
yeah.
Drugged up.
Well,
and
that's
you're then
that's
taken
really too bad.
What
in general, hospitals. There's a wonderful critique of them by Ivan Illich, who you may know of, but many younger people don't anymore, who wrote Medical Nemesis, if you go to a hospital, you have a better chance of dying than if you don't. Actually, statistically, there's something like 60. In the time of his writing, he had studies that said like 50% of hospital beds are filled with iatrogenic disorders, I mean, doctor-caused disorders, by maltreatment of their people. By not out of malice, of course, but out of like a kind of artificial deconstruction of the human being and a mistake of what a human being really is, and like giving them all kind of weird things with side effects and hacking them up and doing all this stuff that isn't that good. And also, actually, from a Tibetan point of view, hospitals have become really unhealthy places in that various negative spirit entities frequent them because they find weakened people in them who they can afflict. And there are these such negative spirit entities in this world, according to the Tibetans, and I think there, although there are less of them in an electrified country, there's something to Ghostbusters. They say, the Tibetans say when they came down to the electrified India that there were less of those kind of phenomena than they used to have in Tibet. Because somehow the ghosts get scared off by an electric grid buzzing and humming. They don't like it. They love it in a not electrical place, then they can run around and bother people. But I think there are these antibiotic-resistant microbes, right? In the hospitals nowadays, you know, I've heard microbiologists talk about the plagues that are coming, you know, that we can't control because we've armed them against all our medicines. And but there's also more subtle entities that afflict people. So first of all, hospitals are really dangerous, I think, personally. But sometimes they're really necessary. When you break something, then they know how to fix it, and they do. Then it's really great. But otherwise, I don't know. And that's first of all. And then second of all, a death that is considered like a crime or a problem or a horrible thing, which is huge contortions we go through in our culture, because we have this wrong theory that all you are is your body, your living body. And when it goes, that's the end of you forever, and you never meant anything anyway, and so it's a big problem to you. So therefore, whatever gyrations we can do to keep some rotten body going, even when rejuvenation is the cheapest form of death, is the cheapest form of rejuvenation, right? It doesn't require surgery. Just requires like going down, floating downstream, flushing yourself, and staying in a good mood, and finding a nice mom. And decent dad, if you're lucky. And then you have a new young body. And if you're really hip, you can make sure you're in a town you always wanted to live in. That was going to be one of my popular books that I never got around to writing. How to Be Reborn on Fifth Avenue. But I never got around to it. What? I'm sorry?
If that is your paradise.
If it's a bonus, oh, it's not bad Fifth Avenue. It's a nice view of the park, you know. Luckily, we had Frederick Olmsted making that one decent park, keeping the developers from making Trump towers all over it. And it is nice, Central Park. I grew up sledding on 81st Street, you know, south of that museum.